while ago, I asked a question about fish and why there's no relief for Shkita, and you said because they're considered dead. So, by that logic, we're not allowed to bite like a living animal, like tear a limb off or whatnot. Yeah. After I catch a fish, would I then halakhically be able to just eat it, like just bite from the fish and turn it dead? Yeah. Oh, it is. Because even though it's still flopping around.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's correct.
No, the Isra of Eber Menachai is only when there's a chiyuv of shechita.
Okay.
So when there's no chiyuv of shechita, there's no Isra of Eber Menachai.
Oh,
there's no Isra of blood either.
Yeah.
Fish blood is actually mutter. But the Gemara says that to eat it separately is marasayan. But as long as you're eating it from the fish or there are scales in the blood, so it's actually permitted. Yeah. Yeah.
I was wondering if the Rebbe could explain why there was a need for God to separate the Ten Commandments from the rest of the Torah.
Yeah, so it's very clear. You know, the Ramban wrote a little sefer, actually, in something called Tetzvei HaRamban, in which he shows that all of the 613 mitzvahs are subsumed under different categories of the Aseret HaDibro. So essentially, it's not that HaKadosh Baruch Hu separates the Ten Commandments from the rest of the Torah. Rather, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us an outline or a table of contents to the whole Torah by giving us Ten Commandments. That's through the Ten. So when people say, you know, I'm a good Jew, I keep the Ten Commandments. Well, if they would really keep the Ten Commandments, that would be actually true, because the Ten Commandments include all 613. Now, it's a little, you know, difficult to figure it out, you know, which commandment is shatness, you know, involved, you know. But the Ramban actually squeezes them in. The Ramban shows that these are broad headings, and these broad headings do include Tariyag Mitzvahs. So basically, therefore, the Aseret HaDibros would be an example of conveying information in a short, organized way so that people will be able to see what they're able to grasp and understand.
It's not making one part important.
That's correct. Now, you do know that the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos that originally they used to read the Aseret HaDibros every single day in the Beis HaMikdash to commemorate Matan Torah, but the Chachamim discontinued the practice because some people were saying only the Aseret HaDibros are important, the rest of the Torah is not important. So the Chachamim were actually reluctant to give any unique importance to it. And there's a tshuva from the Rambam, that's it's not in the Mishnah Torah, but the tshuva from the Rambam says, therefore, that the custom of people standing up during the reading of Aseret HaDibros is improper, because you're implying this is more important than the rest of the Torah. Now Rav Moshe has a tshuva that says that's not really a problem, because since we stand up for other parts of the Torah as well, and we also stand up a few psukim before, a few psukim afterwards, so we're not making a point only the Aseret HaDibros. So the minog is not like this shuv of the Rambam, but the Rambam actually says it's improper to stand up for the Aseret HaDibros. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the Tanya. I've heard mixed things about this sefer, and I was wondering if you could tell us what it is, whether or not it treads on Epicurus territory, and all that stuff.
Well, Tanya is, you know, it's just a phrase that means we learned in a Braisa, and the only reason it's called Tanya is because the very first word of the Sefer Tanya begins Tanya, quotes a Braisa in Nida. Tanya was a Sefer, and I see quite a few people, or no, I see a few Tanyas here, so I won't report you, but... but the Tanya was written by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was Rav Schneer Zalman. He is known in Lubavitch circles as the Alter Rebbe, the old Rebbe. Rav Schneer Zalman was a Talmud of the Midrash Mezerich, who was the Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov. And the Bala Tanya, as he's called also, was an extremely great Talmud Chacham, not only in Kabbalah and Chassidus, but he was a great, great posek and a great, great bucky in Shas and Shulchan Aruch. And in fact, he actually wrote a revised Shulchan Aruch that is called Shulchan Aruch HaRav. Now, Chabad people just call it Shulchan Aruch, but I mean, we call Shulchan Aruch Yosef Cairo, but this is called Shulchan Aruch HaRav. And the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, although we don't always follow him, is an absolutely authoritative posek that is quoted by the Mishnah Brura, by the Aruch HaShulchan, by all Achronim, all the time, right? So it is a very, very choshev and esteemed posek. Now, Rav Schneur Zalman developed a type of chassidus that was different than the prevailing chassidus. most of the Hasidus that existed at the time and actually since emphasized motion and the like. Rav Shneur Zalman invented a Hasidus that's almost not Hasidus in many ways, called Chabad, in which he was very suspicious of emotional arousal, because emotions come and go. And he felt that connection to God must be predicated on the intellect. Now, whether modern Lubavitch is that way or not is a separate question, but the Alter Rebbe specifically wanted a greater Hasidus that was very grounded in contemplation, in thought, in philosophy, and he also wanted to diminish the role of Rebbe. Again, you can ask yourself whether Chabad is faithful to that, because he basically felt a Rebbe is not there to do miracles, a Rebbe is not there to answer questions about where you should invest your money. The Rebbe is there to be a spiritual guide so that you will do the Avodah yourself and raise yourself. The Rebbe is there as a teacher. In many, many ways, Lubavitch was the only Hasidus that really came out of Lithuania. And it's a very Litvisha Hasidus. It is a very Litvisha Hasidus, unlike the Poland and Hungarian varieties of Hasidus. Now, the Alter Rebbe devoted many, many hours to counseling people, to being madrich people, but many people couldn't see him, he couldn't, you know, also time, so eventually he decided to write down, essentially, the basic principles of spiritual counseling. And Tanya is really a manual regarding the spiritual struggles that human beings go through, that Jews go through, in their Avodas Hashem. And one of the chidushim of the Bala Tanya is, in fact, the actual name of the Sefer HaTanya is the Book of Beinonim. That's its official name. Book of Beinonim. What does that mean? We know that there are three categories of people. There are tzaddikim, there are Beinonim, there are Rishoyim. The Rambam gives you a simple definition. If you're more mitzvahs than Averis, you're a tzaddik. More Averis than mitzvahs, you're a Rasha. And if you're equally balanced, you're a Beinonim. But that's a very problematic definition, because that would mean at 10 a.m. I'm a tzaddik, at 10:01 I'm a rasha, and I do one aveira, at 10:02 I'm a benoni. I mean, that does not have any permanent status. So the Bala Tanya actually learns 99.999% of the world are benonim, ranging from the greatest gadol hador to virtually the worst person, because benoni means people who live in the world of struggle. The very atypical definition. That if you still struggle between good and evil, and sometimes you win and sometimes you lose, you are living in the world of the Beinoni. The Tzaddik, according to his definition, is somebody who has already conquered his Yetzer Hara. Now, perhaps there are no Tzaddikim at all in the world, right? Because even the greatest Tzaddikim have struggles. And therefore, the Tanya was designed to give people chizuk, because people often felt, and they feel today, that if I still have evil inclinations, if I'm still struggling, I really haven't succeeded. And the Tanya was designed to write that the whole tachlis of most of the people in the world is to live in that world of struggle and learn how to vanquish and learn how to go on and learn how to not get broken or depressed or saddened. Right? So the Tanya is about the spiritual battle that exists between the animal part of ourselves and the godly part of ourselves. We would call it Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara, but he defines it in terms of multiple souls. There is the animal passion within me. And by the way, he located, even spiritual arousal can come from the animal soul when it's based on naked emotionalism. So animal soul could even be good things, but it's not really coming from the godly soul. You see? And it's a very, very beautiful book. It's not at all Epicurus, except for one aspect I'll mention in a moment. And Tanya technically does not belong to Lubavitch Hasidus, although it was the Alter Rebbe. Tanya is a sefer that belongs to Klal Yisrael. It's a classic of philosophy, mysticism, and Musar, all in one. It gives encouragement to many people. It teaches them the dynamics of struggle. It talks about not being broken when there are disappointments and setbacks, because that is inevitable. Many, many Hasidic groups used to learn Tanya. Ger used to learn Tanya and the like. There were many Litvisha groups that learned Tanya and Torah Vadas, Rav Dessler, for example, and the like. What has happened, though, is that Tanya has become a casualty of the politicization of Chabad and other groups, meaning since it's identified as a Chabad sefer, and Chabad is dangerous because of Mashiches and everything else, so Tanya became a casualty. But technically, learning Tanya has nothing to do with any of those controversies. Now, the only issues of what you might call apikorsis in Tanya are issues that are very, very subtle, and most of us wouldn't even notice them on the radar, but they were. They were, and theoretically are, very, very big issues, but for most of us, we don't really comprehend them as fighting words. And that is the issue of tzimtzum and godliness. The Arizal, who lived before the Tanya and before the Vilna Gaon, talked about the idea. He raised a very simple question. If God is everywhere, how can I exist if God is supposed to be in this space? And he developed the idea that God had to contract and withdraw into himself in order to make room. Now again, obviously this is something that's infinitely deeper than this idea, but this is called tzimtzum. So the question becomes, is tzimtzum a reality, or is tzimtzum just kind of the illusion that allows us to think that we're here and we're not really here, we're really just a reflection of God, and there is only God? And the Hasidus took the position that tzimtzum is not a reality, and in fact there is God in everything and everywhere. Now the Vilna Gaon considered that apikorsis, because the Vilna Gaon said that is equivalent to pantheism, to say that there's God in this table, to say that there's God, you know, in me, so to speak, could lead to the problem of Avodah Zorah. So God creates, God maintains, everything exists because of God's will, but you not say it actually, you know, is God. Now, as I say, you can learn 99% of the Tanya and not really confront that particular issue, and that's a very subtle issue. I mean, you know, most of us are not going to, make a big macha because of some idea of tzimtzum, which is different between the Grah and the Bava Tanya, but that was a major Kabbalistic issue. The nature of godliness within every person and even within the inanimate. But as a sefer generally, as a guide to Avodas Hashem, it's a very, very important sefer. Now, another thing I want to point out too, though, and that is, it's very, very fascinating. All of you are familiar with the Nefesh HaChaim. Now, the Nefesh HaChaim was written by the Vilna Gaon's disciple, Rav Chaim Volozhiner. And the Nefesh HaChaim and the Tanya came out around the same time. And in reality, although the Tanya came out a little earlier, the Nefesh HaChaim makes no reference to Hasidus directly, and makes no reference to the Tanya. But in fact, it's almost a dialogue. It's very, very fascinating. The Chaim Volozhiner is speaking to the Bala Tanya. The Bala Tanya is speaking back. Sometimes there is that way in Svarim. In fact, it's actually a very good way of learning Svarim, although we don't do it commonly. And that is, the Svarim are talking to each other. The Nefesh HaChaim wanted to address certain nekudas that he thought that the Tanya was incorrect about. And part of that would be the role of Talmud Torah, as you might expect. Now, of all of the Hasidic Rebbes, there is no question that the Bala Tanya was the greatest Talmud Chacham and the most connected to traditional Gemara learning. He was not at all like the Hasidic Rebbe that's not connected to Torah learning. The Bala Tanya was deeply connected to Torah learning. But the Bala Tanya emphasizes, in addition to emphasizing the importance of Torah learning, he emphasized the importance of how you have to connect that learning to practical action and bring it down to earth. By contrast, Shar Dalet of the Nefesh HaChaim, which is really the Bible of the yeshiva world, it's really the mission statement of the yeshiva world, advocates the extreme idea that pure, undifferentiated learning, no matter how impractical, no matter how unconnected to your reality, is the highest way of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it could be in that emphasis there was a little bit of difference there. So I don't know if this is enough to give you some insight into it. But certainly, nobody could call the Tanya apikorsis except on the issue of tzimtzum, which is a very rarefied issue that's not even addressed very much in the Tanya. But it is a Kabbalistic work. Now, it's not a heavy Kabbalistic work, meaning it's a Kabbalistic work that can be relatively accessible. But it is Kabbalah, and of course Nefesh HaChaim is also Kabbalah. and therefore it might be somewhat unfamiliar. And you have to be careful too, because since today, Tanya is controlled by Chabad. And again, I don't mean to even be negative by that expression. So a lot of times, the take you'll get on Tanya is connected to Chabad's current philosophies. And Chabad's current philosophies are not always what the Alter Rebbe intended. Certainly the glorification of Rebbe worship, whether you agree with it or not, and again, I'm not expressing an opinion on that, is absolutely the opposite of the Baal HaTanya. The Baal HaTanya wrote letters specifically telling his Hasidim, do not come to me for brachos. That's not what a Rebbe does. Right, so Chabad then was very different than how Chabad eventually became. Yeah.
I heard that Rebbe Moshe Feinstein refused to read the Tanya. Is that true?
I never heard that. And, you know, I have a feeling it's probably not true.
Okay.
You know, we live in a world of lies, and these lies are invented all the time. So I would not, I'm not saying it's not true, but I would give it no credence. Yeah.
Nowadays, a lot of Jews are just not in the know, and I guess you could say ignorant. Do we have like a modern day apikorsum, and what exactly would constitute a modern day apikoros?
Well, you know, some people say the last apikoros was Baruch Spinoza. Spinoza does have the dubious distinction of being a knowledgeable, learned Jew, you know, who, you know, turned his back on everything and was excommunicated for it in Amsterdam, and Spinoza is the real apikoros, the real thing, so to speak. To be an apikoros, you have to be a fairly learned person. You know, they tell the story about a person in Minsk who wanted to become an apikoros. He didn't want to learn anymore, didn't want to keep Shabbos anymore, so he was told that if he wants to become an apikoros, he has to meet with Yasula, the apikoros. Yasula is the official apikoros of Minsk. So he goes to the university libraries, he goes to the bars, he goes to the coffee houses, he wants to find Yasula. Can't find Yasula, so finally somebody directs him to a base medrash, where all he sees, like the middle of the night, he sees a man with a long white beard, you know, sitting over a Gemara. He says, hey, this couldn't be the apikoros, and he says, I'm looking for Yasula. He says, yeah, I'm Yasula. He says, well, I'm told Yasula is an apikoros. He says, yeah. He says, well, okay, well, I want to join your club. So Yasula says to him, okay, have you finished Talmud Bavli with Taisus? He says, well, no, I don't believe this stuff. He says, you know Chumash and Rashi, at least? He says, no. He says, you're no apikoros, you're just ignorant. You know, and you know, there's a lot of truth to that. Most people may not qualify for the status of Rasha or apikoros simply because they never had the knowledge, they never had the exposure. And even if they learned a little bit, you know, that doesn't automatically mean, you know, they had the knowledge. You could be in yeshiva and know something, but that doesn't qualify you. Because of this, we have many, many heterim in halacha. Again, some poskim don't agree with them regarding mechalalei Shabbos who touch wine, that today we don't answer the wine. We count people for a minyan. We give them aliyos, right? Simply because we call them tinok shenishba, babies who were kidnapped, you know, just because they didn't have the knowledge. The Chazon Ish says, the Gemara says in Apikoros, you might be allowed to kill. And even if you don't kill him, but, you know, if he falls down a pit, you can take away the ladder. So the Chazon Ish, that's what Gemara says. So the Chazon Ish says that doesn't apply to Bizmanazah, because we have Hesker Panim. On the other hand, let me point out, there's another school of thought from Ephraim Soloveitchik that says that the reason why you're not Bikiris is not relevant. Because belief in the 13 principles of faith is like a ticket of admission to Olam Haba. Now, let's say I want to go to a movie, right? And I need admission. Let's say I go to the cashier or the grocery store, and I say, you know, I'm poor, I don't have the money, I lost my credit card. All right, so maybe food they'll give me, but, you know, I want to go to a movie. Just, you know, I just don't have the money. Well, the cashier will say, I feel sorry for you. But if you don't have the money, you can't come in. So if Chaim looked at apikoros that way, he says, we really don't care. In fact, the expression is, an apikoros is nebuch an apikoros. You know, it's sad, meaning we really don't care why you don't have the right beliefs. If you don't have the right beliefs, the mitzias, you have not attained that which is necessary to be connected to the Jewish people. So we have different views on this. Do I view apikoros as a type of avera, in which case there are extenuating circumstances, there are excuses, there's mitigation? Or do I view it as kind of a condition for admission into the fellowship of the Jewish community, in which case excuses are not relevant, you just don't have, it's like saying, let me be a heart surgeon because I couldn't afford to go to medical school. You just can't be, you haven't achieved what you need. Now, you may ask a question about divine justice. If somebody is indeed a Tinoch Shenishma who never had background, and now you're telling me he's not going to go to Olam Haba because he's an Apikoros, but what could he have done? Where's the fairness of that? That's a good question. And here we have to posit that Rav Chaim must be a little bit of a Kabbalist here, and that's where the idea of Gilgal comes in, reincarnation. The reincarnation comes in a way to indicate that everybody will get a chance, even if in this life they could not achieve it. So, there are two different views in this, that's all I can tell you. The prevailing view of modern Poskim is to view apikorsis as in the nature of a sin for which we do have exonerations, or at least mitigations, of Tinoch Shenishma. Now, within that limit, can there still be a real apikoros? Well, this gets us into an interesting question of whether Tinoch Shenishma can encompass emotional problems. For example, let's say you have, and we do have, a kid who grew up in a frum home, went to yeshiva, learned Gemara, knows halacha, and decides at some point he doesn't believe. Now, to describe that as a Tinoch Shenishma in the classical sense is really not right. Tinoch Shenishma is somebody who didn't learn, doesn't know. Here is somebody who knows. So you would think, superficially, that has to be a real apikoros, because this person learned all of his life and rejected it. So it gets tricky, and again, I'm not giving you a psak, because some say, based on the Chazon Ish, that just as a person can be blinded and overwhelmed by his intellectual deficits, he can also be blinded and overwhelmed by emotional blockages that exist at a time of divine concealment and Esther punim. So one can be the equivalent of Tinoch Shenishma because of emotional issues as well as intellectual ones. Now, you may then ask me, well, if that's the case, then how could there ever be an apikoros in world history? I mean, Elisha ben Avuya, right? Elisha ben Avuya, the one Tana, who's called Acher, the apikoros. So what happens? He sees a child at the behest of his father climb up on a tree and chase away a bird, take the egg, and the child falls off the tree and dies. And Elisha ben Avuya says, hey, there are two mitzvahs in the Torah for which the Torah says you get long life. One is kibud av v'yam, and the other is sending away the bird. And here the kid did both. I can't believe in the Torah. Now, what you can say the same thing. Once you factor in these emotional issues as negating apikorsis, then nobody could be an apikoros. Well, it's a good question, but we have to posit, like the Chazon Ish says, that there are times in which God's presence is more perceptible, and therefore a person is held accountable for not holding it there. And there are times when God's presence is less perceptible. And the Chazon Ish calls our zaman a zaman of hester panim, and therefore the only way you can reach people is not by condemnation, but only by reaching out to them with love. So, it's a good question. How to characterize individual people is a very complicated issue. Some would say, in the Reform movement, they would differentiate between followers and rabbis. But I'll tell you the truth, the average Reform rabbi is not very knowledgeable in Judaism. Just a fact. I don't mean to be pejorative. I mean, some of my best friends are rabbis. Yeah. Actually, it's true. I mean, I have relationships with Reform rabbis, and there are things I've done together with them, stucco projects, and the like. But quite literally, a typical Reform rabbi basically graduated a secular college, didn't have any yeshiva background at all, graduated a secular college, and after college enrolled in a 6 to 8 year program indeed, but in that 6 to 8 year program most courses are history. I mean, they learn Gemara. Let me put it this way, a good capable Reform rabbi has the competency of a maybe a seventh grader in the yeshiva in Gemara. That's a good Reform rabbi. Most of them are less. So the truth of the matter is, a person's Reform rabbi is also a Tinuk Shenishba. Now, maybe the old-time, you know, Orthodox person, the first Reform rabbis, they were Orthodox and they rejected it. That might be a different thing, and even then you have the emotional issues and the like. But it's clear that most Reform rabbis are not significantly in a different boat than their own congregants, as it were. So I would be very, very minimal in the use of labels like apikoursis. Yeah.
Where does the concept of Moshiach ben Yosef come from?
Yeah, Moshiach ben Yosef is a very, very enigmatic figure and concept. It is one isolated reference, one reference only. I mean, there are many references to the Zohar, but in the Gemara, thank you, there is one reference to a pasuk in Zechariah. The pasuk in Zechariah discusses the awful wars of Gog and Magog. Before Moshiach comes, there's going to be awful cataclysmic battles. Now, the Mefarshim debate, you know, have we already had Gog and Magog? Maybe it was World War II. Maybe it's the Arab-Israeli conflict. Maybe it's the Cold War. Maybe we haven't had it yet, which is very, very scary. There is a comment from the Vilna Gaon that I'm trying to look up. I have not been able to find it, but it's quoted that the war of Gog and Magog is going to last for 9 minutes. Now, when people read that, that made no sense. What type of war can last for 9 minutes? Unfortunately, we do know what type of war could last for 9 minutes, and if that's what Gog and Magog is, that's very scary. But be it as it may, in its description of the wars of Gog and Magog, it talks about eulogies, that women will cry and men will cry. And by the way, the Gemara in Sukkah darshans from that pasuk the obligation of mechitza. Men cry in one place, women cry in another. That's actually the source. The source of mechitza is the hesped. And the Gemara says, and what is the hesped for? Moshiach ben Yosef, who gets killed in the war of Gog and Magog. That I believe, I can't promise you, but I believe that is the only reference in the Babylonian Talmud to Gog and Magog. I'm sorry, to Moshiach ben Yosef, who will be killed in the war. And the logic, the place of Moshiach ben Yosef is the following. The Gemara says that God's throne cannot be complete until the downfall of Amalek. Amalek must be destroyed before God's kingdom can be established on earth. The Gemara in Bava Basra tells us, however, that Amalek can be vanquished only by the children of Rachel and not the children of Leah. That is why Shaul was given the commandments of eradicating Amalek. He is from the tribe of Binyamin. So the role of Moshiach ben Yosef, maybe he's only a private in the war against the Nazis. Now, he may not have a public role at all, although the Gemara seems to indicate we'll know when he dies, is to eradicate the kochos of Amalek via the children of Rachel, to pave the way for Moshiach ben David. And this goes back to the Torah itself, where it was Yosef HaTzadik who paved the way for the Jews to come to Mitzrayim before Yehuda came. So the same way that Yosef paved the way for Yehuda, Moshiach ben Yosef paves the way for Moshiach ben David. Now, there is a sefer written by the Talmud of the Vilna, one of the Talmudim of the Vilna Gaon, Rav Hillel of Shklov. And this is called Kol HaTor, which means the voice of the turtle dove. It's based on a pasuk in Shir HaShirim. And there are those who claim this was a fort because it has things that, in the name of the Vilna Gaon, that are not in accordance with conventional yeshivish readings. But Rav Chaim Friedlander, Zatzal, did say that this is considered a genuine work of the Vilna Gaon. It's even available in translation, although I have to say that this is probably the worst English translation I've ever seen of any sefer, but it is available in translation. And what Kol HaTor is, it's a highly Kabbalistic treatment of the Vilna Gaon's thoughts on the return to Eretz Yisrael. Now, you know, the Vilna Gaon himself wanted to come to Eretz Yisrael, and for mysterious reasons, he never made it. And people are still debating, why didn't he make it? But many of his Talmidim did come to Eretz Yisrael. And in fact, they are the main foundation of the Ashkenazim in Eretz Yisrael, certainly Yerushalayim. The Sfardim were here first. That's why Rav Avi Yosef actually says, you know, Ashkenazim follow the Ramah and Sfardim follow the Beis Yosef. Rav Avadya's opinion is that all Ashkenazim have to follow the Beis Yosef because Sfardim were here first, and when Ashkenazim moved to a Sephardic community, they have to take on the Minhagim of that community. Suffice to say the Ashkenazic poskim don't agree with that, but that's Rav Avadya's argument. But be it as it may, the Talmidim of the Gra built many of the neighborhoods of Yerushalayim. They built Mea Sharim, they built all the neighbors outside of the old city in the 19th century, and they weren't just people who did kolelim and yeshivas, although of course they did that. They were involved in bricks and mortar. They built buildings, they bought fields, they farmed. Their manifesto was based on this Sefer Kol HaTor, where the Vilna Gaon says the following idea. Mashiach ben Yosef is understood on two levels. On one hand, he's supposed to be a real person who will be killed in cataclysmic wars. On the other hand, he represents a certain symbol of Geula. And that symbol of Geula is that before we're zocha to the supernatural Geula of Mashiach ben David, we have to engage in what you would call the natural process of building up Eretz Israel, by settling it, by farming it, and the like. And he says that if Klal Yisrael adopts the idea of Mashiach ben Yosef, that can replace the need for a person who is going to be killed. And therefore the Vilna Gaon, so the reason why some people didn't like this sefer is, the Vilna Gaon seems to be endorsing Zionism before there was Zionism. The Vilna Gaon seems to be saying there is a mitzvah to come to Eretz Yisrael, which of course anyway the Rishonim said there is. There's a mitzvah to farm, a mitzvah to build up the land. The Vilna Gaon talked about the idea that there has to be, instead of saying that we'll wait for Mashiach to bring the Jews back to Eretz Yisrael, the Kol HaTor says it is our coming to Eretz Yisrael, building up the society, strengthening it both materially and spiritually, that is like Yosef, who prepares the ground for Mashiach ben David. Now, the Vilna Gaon did not talk about having a state of Israel. That's a separate issue. But he very much talked about physically being Osek in Binyan Haaretz. So that's what Mashiach ben Yosef is. So it's we don't really understand a lot about it. But the Vilna Gaon's chiddush was that it can be a person or it can be an idea. And the idea might supplant the personal identity of that entity. Yeah.
So how come the Talmud leads Jewish communities to not live in Israel and not in the world, and the big Talmud rabbis also?
Well, it is a very good question. Of course, this question was raised by the Kuzari, more than 1,000 years ago, and the Kuzari has the Melech. The Kuzari is this. Yeah. Dialogue between the king of the Khazars and the rabbi. We really made up both sides of the story. The Kuzari is a fictional novel, you understand. In other words, there was a nation of Goyim, the Khazars, who converted to Judaism. Rav Yehuda Halevi took that true story and he created dialogues between the king and the rabbi in order to explore the philosophy of Judaism. But he made up both, it's made up in the sense that He's putting words in people's mouths to express the ideas of the Torah. So he has the king ask the chaver, says, Rabbi, I don't understand you Jews. You pray three times a day that God should bring you back to the land. And now you have a chance to go back, and nobody goes back. And the chaver answers, and that's Rav Yehuda Halevi's own voice, No Melech, king, this is our eternal shame and humiliation. That we are like the twittering of birds. This is before there was Twitter. We are like the twittering of birds in which we ask Hashem for something over and over and over again, and when He gives it to us, at least part way, we don't want it. Now, let me point out that Rav Yehuda Halevi wrote the Kuzari in the 11th century. Now, going to Eretz Yisrael in the 11th century was mighty hard. The trip was tremendously dangerous, and once you got here, there was nothing here. Desolate, destroyed. If there was a criticism going back to the 11th century, than what it is today, you know, is many, many more times where, you know, the major inconvenience is that you know, that awful, 12-hour flight on El Al, you know, which again, I mean, that is pretty awful, but still, relatively speaking, you know, you can get Ben and Jerry's and you can get, you know, anything you want, American peanut butter, all of those things that used to hold back Aliyah, don't apply today. So really, it's a very, very difficult reason. Like, why do most of us not come to Eretz Yisrael? Now, you could say, well, so many Gedolim don't come. You know, one might say, well, Moshe Feinstein didn't come, why do I have to come? Well, okay. Of course, one could raise the argument, well, did you, you follow Moshe Feinstein, well, did you learn, you know, 15 hours a day like a Moshe Feinstein? You know, why do you only follow a Moshe Feinstein when it comes to not coming to Eretz Yisrael? You know, you don't follow a Moshe Feinstein in any other way, and the like. Certain rabbis felt that their role was to help people in Chutz La'aretz, because as long as there are Jews in Chutz La'aretz needs leaders. I mean, that is true. You can't always abandon flock, you know, and say any... And that is a difficult question. I mean, I as a rabbi in a much smaller scale, you know, I face the same thing. You know, you want to live in Eretz Yisrael, but are you abandoning people that need you? And even if you're not a rabbi, you know, the same thing. You might be giving shiurim, you might be a person in a community that is helping people, that is benefiting people. So, I'm not saying al pi halacha, every single person must be in Eretz Yisrael. But every single person must think about why I'm not in Eretz Yisrael. You know, in other words, it has to be on the radar. It has to be in your consciousness. If it's not in your consciousness, there is something wrong. If you're conscious of it and you realize it is the right thing, but you come to the conclusion that you have individual factors, one can respect that. One should talk to a Rav and a Posek and work that out. But that's a totally different thing than the massive indifference that is in the average American Orthodox Jew's mind. I'm talking about Orthodox Jews here. I'm not talking about non-religious people. The average religious person literally does not give it a thought. It's not a blip on the radar screen. And that, the Kuzari says, is a very, very regrettable point. And the Vilna Gaon, again, says that that is Mashiach ben Yosef. By the way, one thing about the Vilna Gaon, the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon said that they felt that their Rebbe was a reincarnation of Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's why he couldn't enter Eretz Yisrael. Because it was Nigzar that the Neshama of Moshe Rabbeinu could not come to Eretz Yisrael. And he said that was the only explanation they had for why he could not come. Now that's what the Talmidim said. But the Vilna Gaon said on himself that he is a reincarnation of Mashiach ben Yosef. And that's why he felt he had a mission to build up Eretz Yisrael, not just in a spiritual way, but even in a physical one. By the way, just to give you an example of the influence of the Vilna Gaon, you know, in Yerushalayim, we duchen every day. Now, why do we duchen every day? As you know, in Chutz La'aretz, Ashkenazim, only duchen on Yom Tov, and only the Mutzif of Yom Tov. Now, alright, so Sephardim duchen every day, even in Chutz La'aretz. Why do we do it here? Because the Vilna Gaon himself held that duchening should be done every day, even in Chutz La'aretz. He was not able to be miyaset at that. But when his Talmidim came here and they found a majority of Sephardim who were doing it anyway, they saw this as a good opportunity to incorporate the minhag of their Rav, the Vilna Gaon. And that's why the Ashkenazim duchen every day in Yerushalayim. Now, you may know, and I've made a mistake myself here, that in Sfat and in Tveria, they in fact do not duchen every day. They only duchen on Shabbos and Yom Tov at Musaf. And where does that come from? That's very perplexing. But the short answer is that the Talmidei HaGra settled around Yerushalayim, but the Hasidim, many Hasidim settled around Tveria and Sfat. They were the Ashkenazic settlement. And the Hasidim followed the Ramaz Shita, that there's no duchening except on Yom Tov, and they applied that even in Eretz Yisrael. So how did you get to Shabbos? It won't be Yom Tov. But the answer is there was kind of a certain pressure to go with the Gros, so they made a compromise of doing it on Shabbos. A very strange compromise, really. Because there is no opinion that says only do it on Shabbos. I mean, the two opinions in Halacha are you do it every day, or you do it on Yom Tov. the minhag of Tzvat and Tveria to only do it on Shabbos really has no makor, but essentially it was a compromised position between the Gra and what the Hasidim wanted to follow the Ramah's minhag. That is why there are some who feel that it's not a proper minhag at all, and it's proper in Tzvat to duchen every day. I think there might be a minion or two that does it, but it's still not the minhag. The minhag is not to duchen every day. Yeah.
So, my question is, I guess, controversial. When we see like a child, particularly children, suffering and whatnot, is it a Jewish thought to say that, well, they're suffering because of the neshama, it needs, like, for some reason, that neshama needs to go through that suffering or whatnot? Or I say children specifically because they haven't had time to collect sin or anything.
Well, first of all, as is true for all human suffering, particularly all Jewish suffering, one has an absolute chiyuv to do whatever they can to alleviate somebody's suffering. Even if someone has AIDS, for example, even if an adult has AIDS because of homosexual behavior or drug use, you never say, oh, well, you're getting what you deserve, so this is your punishment. We can't factor it in. So certainly one never uses the notion of hashgacha as an excuse to take away anyone's efforts. Now, if, however, we have a situation where there's nothing we can do, then we have to recognize that that which we cannot change is a gezeira from Hashem. But because we're not Nevi'im, we have no right to say why there's a gezeira from Hashem, other than generic teachings that on some level that we can't understand, it is a tikkun for the neshama. Now again, there are many possibilities. Reincarnation can actually mean that the suffering of a child might be a tikkun for averus that were committed in a prior life. That's one of the ideas that reincarnation tries to explain. Now, reincarnation is not in the Gemara, so I'm not going to call it an article of faith, but certainly the Mekubalim, the Arizal, the Chayim Vital, very much did teach the notion of Gilgal. Another notion, although this is very hard for us to accept, is sometimes children suffer because of parents. The Gemara tells us that the sins of parents can afflict minor children. That's why when our child becomes bar mitzvah, we say the bracha, Baruch Shem Tamani. Many people misinterpret that. Many people say, Baruch Hashem, that I'm no longer responsible. So people are saying, oh, Baruch Hashem, he's on his own. It's really the other way. You're saying, Baruch Hashem, that he will no longer be punished because of me. It's the other way. You're saying, I'm glad my child is now on his own, in the sense that, right? So there are many, many, many reasons that we ultimately don't understand. And it's legitimate to say to yourself that whatever Hashem does has inscrutable wisdom that's ultimately to the good, but you really cannot, even in your own mind, be more specific than that. I will say that Gilgal is a common understanding of what is going on under those circumstances.
Is there a concept of original sin in Judaism?
Well, it depends what you mean by original sin. If you mean that because of original sin, man is tainted with evil, man evil, we do reject that, because we say every day in davening, the soul that you have given me is pure. But if you mean by, it depends how you define your terms, basically. If you mean by original sin that we are born with conflicting drives, and those drives include drives for evil and rebellion and the like, yeah, I would say that yes, the chait of the Eitz Hadas was machnis within the human personality, desires, propensities, urges, and drives towards that which is negative. We don't believe that it's simply environmental conditioning. We believe that intrinsically we are born in a world of struggle. Now, I'm not going to address one of the most difficult circular questions, and that is, if Adam didn't have a Yetzer Hara, thank you, until he ate from the Eitz Hadas, then what was the Yetzer Hara that enabled him to eat from the Eitz Hadas? So the Rambam says, well, until he ate from the Eitz Hadas, the Yetzer Hara was outside of him. It was a force in the Nachash outside of him. Eating from the Eitz Hadas made it in him. This is what the Rambam says, and I can repeat those words, but I have to tell you that I honestly don't fully understand them, because something outside of me, unless he physically grabs me, cannot influence me unless there's something inside of me that responds. So to say, the HR is totally outside of me, well, if it's outside of me, in what way does it induce me to follow it? So you still have a problem. But putting that aside, therefore, I think it's a matter of definition. The way that Catholics mean original sin, I think we would reject it. But if original sin just means as a result of the chet of the Eitz Hadas, we have innate struggles with good and evil, then I think that's what the Torah says, and we certainly accept that. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so on the subject of hugging, what's the current sort of overview of individual halacha versus communal halacha? For example, I was reading the book on hugging for the Yiddish community, and it says very strongly, cannot, when you go to Shiva, you cannot give up your minhagim, you have the ancient minhagim.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it says that you're not really supposed to separate from the community, you're not supposed to be a standout from the community. So, you know, what's sort of the story of the individual versus the
Yeah. It is, you know, it is a good, it is a good question. I mean, basically, a lot of it is public versus private, and that is, for example, when you're in a shul, when you're in a minyan, you don't do something that is noticeably different than other people are doing. So, if you're called up for an aliyah, although again, Sfardim I think are sometimes nixchel in this, because Sfardim always do Sfardim stuff no matter where they are. You do, right? Anyway, a public role should be done like the minyan. But if you're doing things privately, or even in shul, if it's something that's not going to be noticed by other people, then you keep the minhagim of your community. Now, you didn't ask us, but with respect to Balei Tshuva, there's a whole different cheshbon here, because there are some opinions that maintain, it's a machlokas, that if a Balei Tshuva comes from a family that was not observant, that breaks the chain of your community tradition, and therefore you are actually free, like a ger. A ger for sure, right? A ger can become whatever he wants. A ger can become Sfardic, Ashkenazic, Chabad, right? So some maintain that a Baal Tshuva has the same liberality in choosing his kehila. Others say that the Baal Tshuva should be mishtadel to link himself to the historical origin of where his family came from. You can go either way with that. But for example, I generally tell people that I posit that they do have the freedom, and therefore they should go to where they're most comfortable. Now that may often mean connection to their family traditions, but it can also mean they could follow the minhagim of the yeshiva and the like. Now, yeshivas in particular have been great destroyers of minhagim. Again, this is an old criticism, even going back to Europe, because what yeshivas did was, they took kids from all over the Jewish world, mainly Ashkenazim in Europe, but Russia, Poland, Germany, and they homogenized them. And as a result, number one, the minhagim were not kept, and number two, the bachurim even lost a certain respect for minhagim, because those are balabatim. That's the old issue about, they're not so learned, they just, do this stuff and show, and b'chlau. So there's a lot of criticism that yeshivas homogenized Klal Yisrael and took away a lot of the minhagim. Rav Avadya said that certainly happened with Sfardim, where there were very few Sephardic yeshivas for a long time. So Sfardim went to Ashkenazic yeshivas, and their minhagim were just ignored, obliterated, and the like. So there is an interesting movement among B'nai Torah now. B'nai Torah, who normally followed their yeshivas, to kind of establish minyanim based on minhagim. I know in Manyekis there's a whole bunch of things. I'll tell you, in Baltimore, it's interesting, Baltimore had an old German shul for many years, the Glen Avenue shul. And this was a German shul of the real Yekis. They would, on Rosh Hashanah, they would say everything in the Master from page 1 to page 998, every single, piyut beginning to end, and Yotzros for the Dalit Parshas, all the stuff that everybody skipped, they said. Now, the B'nai Torah didn't like it. The B'nai Torah said, we want to learn more, we want to have a faster davening, we want to be able to have time to learn mainly. So they broke away and they established their own shuls, leaving the old-timers with the Yotzros, etc. But what then happened was, after many, many years, now a group of B'nai Torah in Baltimore started a shul, to say the Yotzros, to say, so it goes in cycles in terms of your connection to a minna. So minhagim are important, as I say, Bali Tshuva in particular have a certain freedom, and publicly, you know, you don't deviate. On the other hand, it is appropriate to find minyanim that allow you to follow your minhagim. Here we have Sephardic minyanim for slichas, that's a good thing. I know in Ner Yisrael, which of course is an Ashkenazic yeshiva, but we had many, many Iranian students. And Rabbi Neuberger, Aleph HaShalom, who was the executive director of Ner Yisrael, he insisted that the Iranians have their own minyan, and they keep their traditions, including duchening every day, which was not done in the regular yeshiva minyan. So, you know, it is an issue.
Quick follow-up question then. What happens, for example, if, you know, I've chosen my minhagim, but I'm in a community where those minhagim, you know, there's no kegel, so to speak, that's readily available? The halacha, as I learned, it used to be that you have to switch, from, like you said, with the Rabbi Yosef, to the kegel of minhagim when you move, but that doesn't seem to be so much in force anymore.
Yeah, the reason is this. Yeah, that is correct. The reason is, some would say, you know, you're in an Ashkenazi kehila, you got to be Ashkenazi no matter what, or Sephardic kehila, right? That's what Rav Avadya said. But some say that Bizman HaZeh, we don't apply that paradigm. Because Bizman HaZeh, even if you don't have an official minyan, our communities are comprised of people who come from all over the place. In other words, you have to understand that the geography of Europe, and this includes Ashkenazic and Sephardic countries, was very, very different than life is today. You had people who stayed in one place for 1,000 years, and outsiders were very rare, and one could talk about the minhag of the makom, and then there's a halacha that you move to a certain place, you must take on the minhag of the makom. Here, many poskim say, whether it's Yerushalayim or New York or Baltimore or Chicago, Bnei Brak, whatever it is, you can't really talk about the minhag of a makom, because the place has no original inhabitants. Everybody comes from everywhere else. So just because a numerical majority any moment of time happens to do something, that does not create the status of the official minhag makom. So that's why you find, on one hand, you learn the Gemara, and the Gemara seems to indicate, you know, you always change based on the makom, and yet normally that doesn't happen. And that's based on the notion that this is kibbutz galuyos. And as a result, there is no official minhag ha-makom. That's the idea today.
Someone can, you know, like, take a pasuk and superimpose his own ideas, even though that's not the real pshat.
Who does that? You said somebody?
Some people.
Oh, yeah.
Some,
right.
Not even particular, but like some people. Yeah. They have a nice idea, and they want to.
Right.
And then some people have spoken against that.
Yeah, Maral has all the, he considers it very, very bad.
Right. So, yep. Let's say on the Maral, if you look at, like, the Gemara, a lot of the drushes that we make from Sukkim and Menach seem to be taking it way out of context. And it seems to just be that it sounds like a Miyafa, the.
Yeah, in other words, the question you're raising is that that kind of artificial interpretation seems to be exactly what Chazal do in numerous midrashim. What the Maral is critical of, in which you take a verse out of context and you play with translations that are not really the translations of the words, plays on words, puns, which the Maral says is totally improper. Chazal do that all the time. Chazal do that all the time. Yeah. So number one, the Maral would answer that Chazal are different than non-Chazal. That's one basic distinction. But here is the point that you have to understand about drushas. Chazal do have a rule that's called Ein Mikra Yotze Midei Pshuta, meaning to say that a drusha never replaces the simple pshat of the pasuk based on syntax and grammar and the like. Chazal are not saying, when they give a drush, that this is the literal meaning of the verse, or this is even the basic meaning of the verse. But, so what are they doing? What are they doing? Are they just making something up? So the Netziv says the following. When Moshe Rabbeinu commands the Jewish people that everybody has to write a Sefer Torah. This is the 613th mitzvah in the Torah, to write a Sefer Torah. So the lashon is, Kisvu lachem es hashira hazos. Write this song. Write this poem. The Torah is called a poem. The Netziv writes, why is the Torah called a poem? It doesn't rhyme. Sometimes it rhymes. The Netziv says, because the difference between poetry and prose is prose tends to communicate only one message. You know, I write a sentence to communicate something. Poetry may have a primary message, but it'll use certain language to allude and hint to other messages. So the Netziv says that Chazal understand that the primary meaning of a verse is Pshuto Shel Mikra, but when they give so-called artificial drushas, it is always because there is something in the text, and this is a limit in and of itself, some grammatical irregularity, some unusual word, some extra letter, which is there to alert you that there's a double, triple, quadruple elusive meaning here. And there's a very big chachma, which means according to this idea, every single drasha of Chazal is based on some irregularity or hint in the language of the pasuk that there's more here than meets the eye. Now, I have to say, sometimes when we learn Haggadah, we don't take the time to identify, because the Gemara doesn't always say it, right? The Gemara doesn't always say it, just give you an interpretation. But what's the hechrich? Why does it do that? That's a whole limud that's often ignored. The person who really devoted a lot of his life to this is the Malbim. The Malbim, people don't realize, the Malbim did not write a commentary on the Torah. There's a Malbim on the Torah. No, it's not. The Malbim wrote a commentary on the halachic midrashim of the Torah, the Mechilta, the Sifra, and the Sifri, that whenever Chazal make a drasha, the Malbim demonstrates to the laws of grammar and syntax why that interpretation emerges, and it's not a distortion. Now again, the reason the Malbim did this is because this was one of the main attacks of the Reform movement in the 19th century on the oral law, by basically saying rabbinic interpretations of the Torah are artificial and fake and violate the laws of grammar and don't represent accurate translations of Hebrew. And the Malbim wants to show how every drasha actually fits the structure of a verse. Now, I've collapsed the Malbim and the Netziv, but in fact, you might be saying two slightly different points. The Netziv's point is not that all drushas have to be consistent with grammar and syntax. The Netziv's point is, as poetry, it may allude beyond the primary message. The Malbim perhaps even goes further by saying that a true understanding of Hebrew grammar will actually show these interpretations to be the meaning of the verse and not simply superimposed. This is a whole limud that we totally ignore in yeshivas by and large. Again, we know all of us all of us are victims of time, right? We don't have time to do everything. We don't have time to do everything. We don't have time to learn everything. There's so many chach. Rabbi Kiv Eger once said, David HaMelech says, Sas anechi alem resacha, I rejoice over your Torah as if I found a great treasure. Rabbi Kiv Eger says, there's a mixed message there. Imagine that you're put on a desert island, and the desert island is full of jewels as far as you can see. Jewels, diamonds, rubies. And the king tells you, you have 24 hours. Whatever jewels or rubies you can take with you are yours. Whatever you don't take, that's it. Rabbi Kiv Eger says, that's what Torah is. Hashem puts us in the world for 120 years and says, you can take whatever you want. It's yours. What you don't take, you don't have. That's David HaMelech's kind of mixed feeling. I found this great treasure. I have no way of taking it all. But at least be aware that this is something that the Malbim devoted himself to. And in fact, in the Hakdama to Sefer Vayikra, the Malbim gives 613 klalim of Hebrew grammar, which is the foundation of rabbinic drasha in terms of understanding psukim. He identified these different klalim. So those are the approaches, basically. And therefore, the difference is when a modern person does it, just because he superficially wants to squeeze his thoughts into a verse, that's not the same as Chazal, who are looking at a pasuk and they see in the pasuk that there's a call for some additional meaning that's there. It's a very, very different process. Yeah.
What is the name of the book that Malbim wrote on Vayikra?
Yes, so if you look at the take the Malbim on Vayikra, Chumash Vayikra. Yes, the Malbim on Vayikra. And you look at the introduction to the Malbim on Vayikra, it's like a 30-page introduction, and it's called Ayelet HaShachar. So you'll see a 613 klalim of dictum, which was the base, which he identified as the basis of rabbinic drasha. Okay? Okay, stop here, have a good day.